Most Americans are so brainwashed by the time they complete 12 years of government education that they cannot even recognize mass murder by the U.S. government as a crime. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Today we have Scott Horton of the Libertarian Institute, as well as antiwar.com. Please check out his excellent book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Scott, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me as always, Keith. Happy to be here.
I want to quote from bin Laden's 1998 fatwa. He says, "The aim of the United States is also to serve the Jews' petty state and divert attention from its occupation of Jerusalem and murder of Muslims there. The best proof of this is their eagerness to destroy Iraq, the strongest neighboring Arab state, and their endeavor to fragment all the states of the region, such as Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Sudan, into paper statelets, and throughout their disunion and weakness to guarantee Israel's survival and the continuation of the brutal crusade occupation of the peninsula." So what do you think about that? And what was the real motive for the U.S. getting into Iraq War One and Iraq War Two?
All right. Well, so there's a lot there. And you know, I'm certainly not trying to take bin Laden's side here or that kind of thing. But, you know, essentially, there's a lot of truth to what he's saying, and this goes back to the foundations of Zionism that Jacob Jabotinsky and these others urged, the dissolution of the United Arab States that had emerged, you know, under, you know, British control, but as separate nation states out from under the Turkish Ottoman Empire after World War One, and that these states needed to be broken up, and that if all of Israel's neighboring Arab tribes were broken into the smallest units possible and were constantly fighting amongst each other, then that would leave Israel in a strategic position of dominance and, you know, without threats there. And so, and there's a common narrative of especially the Israeli far right who have advocated strategies along these lines in the past, infamously the Oded Yanan plan from 1981 is really worth a look, Keith. And it talks about this. And what's really interesting about it to me in a way is that it begins with just this insane nightmare fantasy kind of point of view that world communism is ascendant and the Soviet Union is going to conquer the world and the world is doomed. The light of reason and goodness will be extinguished and Israel will be alone against all the barbarian planet trying to kill us all. And just, you know, why would anybody think that time was on the Soviet side in 1981? You know what I mean? Give me a break. It's completely ridiculous. But a lot of people, I mean, the CIA was pushing that line. That was a popular narrative on the right, but hardly a realistic one. And of course, the Soviet Union ceased to exist by Christmas Day, 1991, right? So just, you know, just over 10 years later, it didn't exist at all, much less had succeeded in conquering the rest of the planet or something like this. But it's from this absolutely paranoid point of view. And, you know, I think critics of Israel, maybe even including myself, Keith, don't give this, you know, enough credit, the idea that because so many of the founders of Israel were survivors of the Holocaust in Europe, that it's just such an ingrained part of their culture that they could all be killed at any time and that people really want to hurt them because of who they are, not what they do, and this kind of thing. You know, a kind of a parallel narrative to America's terrorism narrative, when the reality is, as we've discussed before, that terrorism is just like America's, you know, bombing of terrorists is a reaction to what terrorists do to us. Terrorist bombing of us is a reaction of what we do to them. It's a war. And so obviously, yes, they're from a different civilization. They're from an Arab and Muslim culture, which is quite a bit different than the dominant culture in the middle part of North America, that's for sure. So it becomes easy for bin Laden to say to his people, look, this is the Jews and the Christians and they're the crusaders and they hate us for who we are. They're trying to kill us, oppress us, steal from us because they hate Islam. They hate goodness. And because they are motivated by their sick, evil Jewish and Christian religions, right? And then on the American side, they say the exact same thing. That you see, these guys, they're Islamist extremists. All they want is to create a global new world order under radical Sunni Islam that we all must bow to. And so we got to fight them over there on their own shores so that we don't have to fight them over here on ours and all of these things. They hate us. Why? Because we're mostly white and Christian and North American and free. And boy, do they hate that freedom. And it's just not true. Right. On either side, these are the simplistic narratives that are used as essentially an excuse for violence in the first place and as shtick to recruit new people to their side of the cause. Right. Ultimately, you know, as libertarians, we are individualists. And I only know just a little bit about it secondhand about public choice theory economics. But it's basically saying that, look, economics apply to people inside government bureaucracies. They are essentially just like everybody, their own individual entrepreneur. Even if you're a wage-earning laborer, essentially you are a businessman selling your labor for time for a price, kind of a deal. Yeah, same thing with a bureaucrat. They'll have their own interests that are paramount, you know, in promoting the various crises and the various narratives that surround them. And so it makes sense from the Israeli point of view to pretend that all their enemies are horrible barbarians rather than their victims who are attempting to retaliate, or in the case of the Palestinians, liberate themselves, previously the Lebanese, to liberate themselves from foreign occupation. Not that that justifies terrorism, which is by definition means targeting innocent civilians in order to create a political reaction that's favorable, et cetera. Which is, of course, evil on by definition. It has nothing to do with justifying any of that, any more than pointing at their terrorism justifies the American side bombing and killing innocent civilians, or the Israeli side bombing and killing innocent civilians over there. But anyway, so that's the frame that all sides cynically exploit, is they hate us because we're good and free and only want to be free of them. And so that's why we have to defend ourselves. That's what they all say. And then it's like a transmission belt of power. The more they commit terrorist attacks, the more excuse the Americans have to oppress them, the more people are driven to their cause. Remember how Zarqawi would slaughter marketplaces full of Iraqi Shiite civilians in order to provoke reprisal attacks against Sunni civilians in order to drive Sunni civilians into the insurgency on his side, right, as a means to an end. That's one horrible example of people willing to do horrible things to innocent people in order to provoke horrible attacks on their own side in order to strengthen their more radical position and marginalize more moderate forces who might seek compromise.
Yeah, the rallying around the flag effect works in more than just one country. There is a book titled Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, and he says that even before the U.S. was selling arms to Saddam in the Iraq-Iran war, Saddam was a CIA asset hired for assassin. Is that true?
Yes, America supported all through the Cold War. The British started it, and America, you know, picked it up from them. The U.S. and Britain working together and with the Saudis supported the Muslim Brotherhood and right-wing Islamist movements, as well as the Ba'athist parties in Iraq and sometimes at least in Syria, against the socialists, the communists, and the nationalists. Those were the enemies. And so they were willing to support anybody against them. So the Nasserites were the nationalists in Egypt. And they didn't even really lean pro-Soviet. The Americans could have gotten along with Nasser if they'd have let him have his independence, but deal with him mostly as an equal. It could have been fine, but they weren't willing to tolerate that. So, you know, the great book about this you got to read is called Devil's Game by Robert Dreyfus, where he just describes American and British and Saudi support for Muslim Brotherhood movements all through the Cold War era and support for Islamists. And then in Iraq, it was the Ba'athists. I'm not sure why they didn't. I guess they did back the Muslim Brotherhood there, you know, to some degrees. but it was really the Baathists that they focused on, because the Baathists were the most efficient. Well, they were set to inherit the power after, as the dominant Sunni faction after the fall of the king. And so there were military coups and so forth. And then when the Baathists took power, I guess in the original coup of 1958, I think it's Qusim was the guy, and Saddam Hussein was his number two guy. And they did a coup in 58 and they succeeded, but then they were overthrown in 2 years. And Saddam Hussein then went into exile in Egypt. And sorry if I'm screwing up the dates here. But I know 58 was the coup. I think it was 2 years later. And then he was exiled to Egypt. And then he was brought back in the late 60s. I forget which year. In the late 60s, the Baathists succeeded in their next coup. And then he was the number two guy from, I think, 69 through 79. And the head of the secret police and with the CIA, even though they were close with the Soviets and were buying their equipment with the Soviets, they were working with the CIA to hunt down and murder Iraqi communists, right? Like Pol Pot, right? Anybody with glasses, line them up and shoot them. That's what the Americans are doing to the Reds in Iraq and using Saddam Hussein to do it. And then in 1979, Saddam Hussein overthrows the old man. And I forgot the guy's name now. Sorry. I was just reading about this recently. I got what Biden's got. Forgive me. But anyway, it was 79 that then Saddam did the coup. And of course, that's the same year as the Iranian Revolution. So Jimmy Carter then made common cause with Saddam Hussein real quick that let's get you to attack Iran for us kind of thing. I think he wanted to do it and asked for permission. And Jimmy Carter gave it to him is really the better way to say that. But yeah. And you know, when we're talking about the worst police state atrocities against innocent civilians, it was the CIA working with Saddam Hussein to round up anybody leaning left and murder them.
Now we have a number of justifications for going into Iraq. One of them is, it's a surrounding deception referred to as the Valerie Plame affair with her and her husband, Joe Wilson. What was the Valerie Plame affair?
Well, the Plame part of it was the revenge by Dick Cheney. But the core of the scandal was there was a fraud, an obvious group of fraudulent documents claiming that Saddam Hussein was buying yellow cake, you know, partially refined uranium ore from Niger in North Africa, which is formerly a French colony. And all their mines are controlled by French companies and they have high security and no such deal ever took place. The whole thing was a hoax. But they sent Joe Wilson, who had been the former ambassador to Kuwait, and I forget where else, maybe Saudi. And they sent him to go and investigate it. I forget if he had been the ambassador to Niger, but he had experience in Niger. So he went and investigated it, and they told him all it was bunk. And so he came home, and I think after the Colin Powell UN speech, but before the war started, he leaked a story to Nick Kristof of the New York Times, which is not a very effective avenue for doing it, I don't think. But he gave it to Kristof, and Kristof said, look, I got an ambassador who says he investigated this story and it's not true and it's a big deal. The IAEA debunked the documents in 30 minutes with Google. They just said, look, the guy whose name is on these documents wasn't even in power at the time, and this kind of stuff, right? It's ridiculous frauds. And but it worked. It was part of the argument for lying us into war. And then what happened was, after the war started in July of 2003, Wilson wrote an article for the New York Times called What I Didn't Find in Africa. And so that got Cheney all pissed off. And essentially, they put the word out that this guy's wife was at CIA and she sent him on some kind of corrupt junket vacation at taxpayers' expense to Niger by intervening and assigning her own husband to go and do this. And so they leaked her name. And she actually was not just an analyst. She was, and I don't know if she was, you know, exactly, you know, her title, but she was at least had an undercover. I don't think she was like a real, what you would call like a CIA officer under the Directorate of Operations, whatever they call that now. I think they changed the name of it. But she did have an undercover identity and had a front company called Brewster Jennings and Associates that was involved in nuclear equipment sales and this kind of thing. And was a front, and she was working on Iran, as my wife reported at the time. She was working on Iran, And that was part of the motive, probably, to you know, burn her and her husband, or her name, was because they didn't want the CIA to know what was going on in Iran, because they wanted to be more effective at lying about what they thought was going on in Iran. And they didn't want the CIA being able to say that, or their fears were unfounded and that kind of thing. Pretended fears were unfounded, that kind of deal. So, but anyway, that was, you know, it was one of the major pillars of getting us into the war. And they learned this from Iraq War One, in the buildup to Iraq War One in 1990, that you got to scare Americans with atom bombs. Anything less than that, and they don't want to support an aggressive war. But if you tell them that Saddam is making atom bombs, then they'll go for it. And the irony is, in 91, they were lying, but then it turned out to be true. They were totally bluffing. And he was years away from actually having one. But he did have a secret nuclear program. And why? Because the Israelis had bombed his above ground open plutonium processing facility and nuclear reactor at Osirak in 1981, which was under the IAEA inspection regime, under the safeguards agreement, because Iraq was a member of the non-proliferation treaty. And so because the Israelis bombed it in 1981, Saddam took it underground and started actually trying to make nukes and trying to enrich uranium up to weapons grade. And it was only after the war that the Americans discovered the program. And then that became part of Cheney's narrative. When they came back 12 years later, he said, look, you can't trust the CIA when they say that Saddam's not making nukes, because that's what they said in the 80s, and they were wrong. And so that, you know, go ahead.
You know, I was actually going to move on to what I thought was a similar competing lie at the time, was anyone in Iraq or members of Al-Qaeda responsible for sending anthrax to congressmen?
Oh, no. Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with that whatsoever. And I think it's still essentially an unsolved mystery. I'll tell you what is a certain fact, and that is that the accused, starting with Stephen Hatfill and then Bruce Ivins, the guy that they eventually convicted after his death, supposedly by suicide, I guess presumably by suicide, that they drove him to, is total BS and should not be believed. There's no reason to believe the narrative that they made about that guy. And essentially, they did seemingly deliberately drive him to suicide and a horrible death by Tylenol overdose, which is just horrible liver failure and just, you know, crippling pain. And they knew he's dying on the floor of his bathroom all day, and they were surveilling him from next door and didn't do a thing. And sat there and let him die. And the reason that, you know, they had showed, I forget if it was his son or his daughter, had just had surgery and was all laid up in the hospital. And they went in corner, showed her pictures of all the people dying of the anthrax and said, your father did this and all of this stuff. And they were going after pressuring his children really bad and all this. They drove him into just a state of despair. So he killed himself. And then they go, oh, yeah, he did it. And then they put this report out claiming that it was him. They had no proof. The whole thing was, you know, and I recommend people, especially read Justin Raimondo's treatment of this stuff at antiwar.com. And Glenn Greenwald wrote good stuff about it. And I interviewed the lady. God, I'm so sorry, man. I forget her name. If you go to my site and Google anthrax, there's this lady expert. I'm so sorry. I'm blanking on her name right now. It's on the tip of my tongue, too. It's killed me. Anyway, if you search anthrax on my site, you'll find there was a lady who was a great debunker of this, had really spent a lot of time on it. Now, I don't know what really happened there, but I do know that there was an op to blame it on Iraq. And they gave this story to Brian Ross at ABC News that, hey, this anthrax is laced with bentonite. And that means Saddam Hussein, because, of course, we know Saddam Hussein's recipe for anthrax somehow. And so anyway, you know, that's how we know it was him. Well, this is a total lie. It was just not true at all. And there were different, there was like hoax letters, and there were different grades of anthrax that were sent at different times. I mean, it's a hell of a thing. I won't tell you my speculation just because I got one, but I can't really base it on anything real. But it was certainly, there was a conspiracy to make it seem like it must have been Saddam and working with Al-Qaeda to do it too. You know, it even said on the envelopes, death to America, death to Israel, and all this. And it was funny at that time in the narrative in America, it was like, who said anything about Israel? Right? Like, what is it, you know? What do you mean? You know, certainly it wasn't the narrative that the towers came down because of revenge attacks based on American support for Israel. That wasn't part of the narrative. It was, you know, but, oh, okay, I guess our cause and their cause are the same, huh? Seems like it now. You know, that was a big part of the narrative. And, of course, got to give credit to Rye Dawson for pointing this one out to me, that it was, well, I think he showed me the Sunday Times, but I followed the chain further. It was originally in Die Zeit, I believe, in Germany, although I could never find the original story. I could only find stories that referred to it. But I believe it, the original story was in Die Zeit in Germany, said right there in the text that Israeli spies say that they witnessed the head of Iraqi intelligence give a flask of anthrax to Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker. So that's what they were trying to do, was frame. This was the connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. Was the same guys who crash into your towers. Is the same guy who sent the envelopes full of poison. And he got it all from Saddam Hussein, full of germs. He got it all from Saddam Hussein. And that was the frame-up job. And that sure as hell is pretty suspicious to me. But at the very least, they were glomming onto the story. Well, we got an anthrax attack. And then, and that was actually, okay, I'm about 90% sure of this. I'm not certain, but I'm like 90% sure that this is right. That was the first story that came out saying that Mohammed Atta had met with Iraqi intelligence in Prague in the Czech Republic, which was a total lie. And I'm pretty sure that that was the original story. And it included right there, Israeli intelligence sources say they witnessed the transfer of anthrax from the head of Iraqi intelligence, which I guess would have been, I'm sorry, I forget the guy. I want to say Naji Sabri, but maybe that's not right. But anyway, it was nonsense. And the CIA and the FBI never believed it and totally debunked it. Dick Cheney was the only one who kept bringing it up, actually inside the government. He would bring it up for years, even after it was debunked. He would keep bringing it up. But the neocons and the media, man, they had a field day with that. And not so much the Israeli anthrax angle. I think they ran a few things like that. But just Iraqi intelligence met with Mohammed Atta in Prague. They just pretended to believe that was true, you know, and they made such a big deal out of it. I mean, this is, you know, that the obvious question would be, well, if that's really true, then how come George Bush didn't start the carpet bombing 9 months ago? You know what I mean? Why are we asking the French and Chinese for permission on the UN Security Council to start a war if actually we're defending ourselves in a war that Iraq already started against us? And the answer is because that's a load of crap. That's why. It wasn't true, but it was enough to get enough Americans to believe it, right? On the margin, it made the difference, right? That's an extra segment of the American population won over toward war because they're hearing the words Saddam Hussein, anthrax, and 9/11 all thrown around near each other a lot for a year and a half, regardless of the fact that it was total nonsense.
Now, I went to Hebrew school for probably about 10 years, and my understanding was that Israel was a geographical area given to Jewish diaspora after the Nazi atrocities. And ever since then, Palestinians just shoot rockets at it because they're very bitter and they're anti-Semitic, along with the Nazis, and Israel simply is there to defend itself. It later occurred to me after doing some reading and research that this is not exactly the story. I'm curious, what is the untold history of how Israel is a very much an aggressor in this situation, as opposed to the people just wanting to defend itself and live in peace?
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, first of all, there are always innocent civilians on all sides of this stuff who have no political power and are just some guy. And so this is, you know, I don't believe in collective guilt and collective punishment and all of these things. And I know that there are a great many people in Israel and, for that matter, American Jews and Jews all over the world who disapprove of the way the thing is, you know, certainly the way it is now. If, you know, not consensus about the creation of the state and everything. But to try to boil it down here, and it's very difficult to. In fact, can you see behind me? Oh, I ran out of copies. I sent them all out. Coming to Palestine by Sheldon Richman. I really strongly recommend this. He also went to Hebrew school as a boy, was raised Jewish and Zionist very much. And then he learned otherwise. And the book is a collection of essays that he wrote over the course of 30 years, coming to grips with understanding what really happened here and what it's all about. I really can't recommend it highly enough. It's just great. Coming to Palestine by Sheldon Richman. But so a few things that you need to understand, I guess. Take the map of Israel that you always see and has this big piece carved out of it, right? The West Bank. And that's the West Bank of the Jordan River. Now, if you just look at that map and you don't know what's going on, it looks like maybe an Arab army invaded from the east and seized this chunk of Israel. And if you listen to the reports, you hear all the time that if there's going to be a deal here, it's land for peace. The only way to get these terrorists to stop attacking innocent Israelis is to give them some land, right? Which presupposes, of course, arguing past the sale, right? Like, hey, what color Corvette are we putting in your park, in your driveway this afternoon? Man, we're going with red or yellow. That's all it is. It's arguing past the sale that, you know, so you just presuppose and assume, presume, because it sounds like what they're implying. And then you infer that, okay, this is all Israeli land. And these terrorists are trying to extort Israel out of some of their land. So they've invaded and seized a chunk, and now they want even more, and they won't give the Israelis peace until they get it. And that's the common narrative. And that's just completely wrong, okay? That's just not what it is at all. It was already a population of people who lived in Palestine. And the Zionist movement to build a Jewish state in Palestine far predated World War II. It had been going on since the late 19th century, and they wanted from the beginning not just to move Jews to Palestine to live, but to create a chauvinist Jewish state at the expense of the people who already live there. And that was the point all along. And most Jews in the world did not go along with it. The American Orthodox and Reform Jews were against it. Most of the Jews of Europe were against it and stayed. And those were the 6 million and or almost 6 million or whatever the number is now, 5 million very high change after that. They were killed, the anti-Zionist Jews of Europe. And so the Zionists were the ones who were left because they were the ones who had fled. Or, you know, and among the rest of the people who were left in Europe, they had their minds changed to go ahead and leave because why stay now? And, you know, King Fahd at the time of Saudi Arabia, when he met with FDR and cemented America's alliance with Saudi Arabia there in their meeting in the Persian Gulf, he said to Roosevelt, well, why give them Palestine at the expense of the people who live in Palestine? Give them the best part of Germany. That's what they deserve, you know, but they didn't do that. And instead, you know, the Americans and the United Nations, well, the General Assembly recommended the creation of two states from the beginning in Israel, one for the Israelis and one for the Palestinians. Now, the map that they drew was completely crazy, but it was just a recommendation. It was no world edict. They had no authority to create a state. They called it a recommendation. But that was supported by the Soviet Union, as well as the Europeans and the Americans at the time. And as soon as they declared statehood at the expense of the Palestinians, the Harry Truman government recognized them immediately. And as Sheldon tells the story in the book, the Zionists made a secret side deal with the king of Jordan that he would keep the West Bank. And so the Palestinians would not get their second state next door to Israel at the same time. So Zionists will always say, well, the UN said we could have a state. Well, they also said that the Palestinians could have a state. That was 75 years ago, and the Palestinians still don't have independence. So when you look at that map and it looks like the Arabs have invaded from the east and seized this West Bank, no, that's what's left, okay, and the Gaza Strip. But in fact, that's not true either, right? Because in 1967, oh, wait a minute, let me go back. when they created a state in 1948, Keith, they cleansed 750,000 people from their homes in order to create Israel. 750,000 people, and including committed horrible atrocities, rapes and torture and murder, especially the Dar Yassin massacre and other like atrocities. The way they seized the city of Jaffa from the people there and all. It's just, the whole thing is just bananas, man. The creation of the state of Israel at the expense of Palestinians. And I have to tell you, the idea, and I'm too young to know this firsthand, but I've learned this through the time. The idea that there were Palestinians there who were removed, that was a crazy white supremacist conspiracy theory, or Arab conspiracy theory, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. This was a land without people for a people without land. Yeah, who would have thunk it? That even though the Bible is from there and everything, that somehow we're going to pretend that the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea was not settled in the year 1948? A land without people? What the hell are you talking about? And in fact, who are those people? Were they the original descendants of the ancient Hebrews? The Roman exile never happened. Those are the sons of the ancient Israelites. And they have been converted to Islam centuries ago, basically to avoid having to pay taxes to their new rulers. But through all the different invasions of that area over the two centuries since biblical times, there never was a massive ethnic cleansing campaign where those people were kicked out. So even if you buy into the theory that the natural rights of the Palestinians who live there and tilled that soil and own that land doesn't count because the Jews have this biblical supernatural property right to come in that supersedes them and grants them the territory, well, that doesn't hold up either, because these are the people who are the descendants of those in the Bible in the first place. And the Europeans, obviously a Lithuanian Jew or a Russian Jew, has a lot more tenuous claim on being truly descended from the ancient Hebrews than the people who actually live there. And, you know, this, the whole thing about the Roman exile, it just never happened. It's just a myth. It's a purely ahistorical myth. And so even on the bogus terms that the Bible creates an eternal supernatural property right for any Jew from anywhere in the world to return to Israel and claim property there, even if you believe that, then you'd have to recognize that property right belongs to those Palestinians first, not Europeans. And of course, the European descended Jews are now, I think, about 40% of the Israeli Jewish population. It's about 60% Jews from around the region. And a lot of that is because of Israeli false flag terrorism, like in Egypt and Iraq, in order to scare the last of the Jews. I mean, they had tens of thousands of Jews still living in Iraq. I don't know how many in Egypt who fled. And it wasn't anti-Semitic terrorism by Shia or Sunni terrorists. It was false flag terrorism by Zionists to scare the Iraqi Jews into fleeing. And that's covered in Sheldon's book as well.
And the groups are like... like Ergon, Haganah, and the Stern Gang? Is that who was behind those false flags?
You know what? I'd have to go back and look at exactly which groups did the false flag. I mean, this is in the 50s, I think, in the early 50s. So this is a few years after the creation of the State of Israel. The groups that you just named, these were the militia groups and really terrorist groups that helped to found the State of Israel, who did the ethnic cleansing campaign that essentially grew into the Israeli army. And they did absolutely, you know, blow up the King David Hotel and slaughter a bunch of civilians to help drive the British out of there. They assassinated a Belgian count. I'm almost certain he was Belgian. I swear to God, I'm going senile here. But there was this important British diplomat whose, you know, job it was to help to secure the rights of both sides. And they murdered him. The whole thing was a bloody wreck. And then, so like I say, they made this secret deal with the King of Jordan to occupy the West Bank, so there could never be an independent, separate Palestinian state there. And then in 1967, well, it's worth mentioning, Israel started the war, and they claimed it was a preemptive strike against an impending attack by Egypt, which was just not true. And later, Menachem Begin, in a speech, admitted that, like, hey, we can lie to everybody else, but we shouldn't lie to each other and ourselves, that Egypt was not moving on us. We took the opportunity to pretend to think that he was in order to start that war. And so then Jordan, Syria, and then Jordan joined in the war and were all resoundingly defeated by Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967. And then Israel took control of the entire West Bank all the way to the Jordan River at that point. Now, they didn't ethnically cleanse all the people of the West Bank then and kick them out. And there are Palestinian refugees all over the Middle East, and including, you know, in North America and Europe and all over the place, who, you know, even though that actually is their property, have no supposed right to return to it. But in the case of the War of 67, they couldn't expel. In fact, I shouldn't say it. They did expel another 200 or 300,000 people during that war from the West Bank. But at that point, that was a rounding error on the millions who lived there. It wasn't enough to make the difference. So now, unlike when they seized what they call Israel proper within the Green Line or the, you know, 67 borders, you know, pre-67 war borders, they kept all the people when they seized all the land. So now you have the Palestinians, who are roughly equal in population. It's about right around 6 million each. And there is a segment of Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, although they are very much second or third class citizens and officially discriminated against in major ways. And that's Christians and Muslim Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel. But then if you combine their numbers with the people of the West Bank and the people of the Gaza Strip, never even mind the refugees around the Middle East who aren't allowed to return home to their land or their father's or grandfather's land. If you take all those, you're talking about roughly equal numbers, almost a 50-50 split. The Palestinians may even be in the slight majority. So what you have is a system where the highest, I guess, supposed caste of these Palestinians, the so-called Palestinian citizens of Israel, are second or third class citizens. Yet the people of the West Bank live essentially in an open air prison, in a minimum security prison. They have no rights whatsoever. The fact that there's something called a Palestinian Authority should not fool you. It's nothing like an independent government. It's not. This is essentially like the strongest prison gang that serve as trustees for the government that truly runs the prison, and that is the Israelis. And the Palestinian Authority was created under the auspices of, yeah, we promise we're going to give you a Palestinian state. It's the two-state solution. And if you just would negotiate with us in good faith, geez, we have no partner for peace, but we sure are trying to negotiate and give back the West Bank and let them have the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I meant to say the Gaza Strip is more like a maximum security prison. It's really more like a concentration camp by the sea. They're completely under siege. And again, Hamas is much more analogous to prison trustees than they are to anything like an independent government in the West Bank. I mean, they are a political party and they provide services and so forth, but they are not an independent government in any way. They are under military occupation and siege, legally and literally. And so these people are not free. They essentially live in an apartheid state like Mississippi in 1920 or like apartheid South Africa in 1980. Okay, that's the situation for these people. They have no rights. They are civil rights in terms of participation in politics, representation in lawmaking bodies, the courts, the executive, in any meaningful way. They have a few seats in the legislature, the Knesset, but by tradition, not law, but by tradition, they are essentially forbidden from being included in any coalition. In fact, as we've seen with Benny Gantz two different times in the recent elections, he could have been the prime minister if only he would have made an alliance with the Arab list, the joint list, but he wouldn't do it. So he would rather lose to Netanyahu than win with the Arabs. And that's how it goes. Well, now, he would have lost some of his Israeli coalition members on the right, but according to some calculations anyway, he would have made up the margin. It would have been okay, but nope. And by tradition, it's always been that way. They're never included in a ruling coalition. So they never have a cabinet post. They never have executive power at all. And that, again, is just the few Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship inside so-called Israel proper, which was not entirely cleansed in 48, right? They're the 20% to the Israeli 80% super-duper majority inside so-called the Green Line or Israel proper there. And they have no real power whatsoever. And then everybody below them has essentially no civil rights and no civil liberties, no real protections. They are, so martial law means when your own military is occupying your neighborhood, and if you disobey an order, you can be shot. Even an order, come here. And if you don't, bam, that's martial law. And this is not that. This is an entire other level of lawlessness beyond that. This is foreign military occupation law. And so, in other words, this would be like if the British army came and took back New York, you know, or what, a foreign army occupying our land in perpetuity and keeping our people prisoner. You know, the people of the Gaza Strip, they're not even allowed to leave. In the West Bank, they're not even allowed to leave. And then when they are, if they ever can get out under any excuse to go to Europe on a scholarship to get an education or something like that, then it's hell to get back in. I mean, the whole thing is an absolute nightmare, man. In fact, I'll recommend to you this recent piece by Peter Beinart. And he's known as, you know, a very important liberal Jewish Zionist writer. And he wrote a very important piece about a month ago called, it's in his magazine, Jewish Currents. And then he wrote a shorter version for the New York Times. And it was essentially on the occasion of Netanyahu's pre-announced, but then delayed, but essentially doesn't matter because it's de facto or de jure, it's the same thing, annexation of the West Bank, which has truly been a fact since 67. And the two-state solution was always just a ruse and a delaying tactic is the truth of it. And Peter Beinart, at the very bitter end, finally said, you know what? I'm crying, Uncle. This isn't right. And we need to not abandon Zionism, but redefine it. We don't need a Jewish state. We just need a Jewish home in the Middle East. And we can live there in peace and with equal rights and in a single state with equal rights with the Palestinians. And we shouldn't have to fear them. And we can do this. And what we're doing is wrong. And it's absolutely untenable. And it absolutely has to be stopped. And the reality is, think about the opposite narrative here, that everybody just hates Jews. And the whole controversy about Israel is that it's Jews that live there and people just wake up in the morning mad about that. That's stupid. Okay. The reality is, and look, you know what? It might be a little bit confusing, right? Because Jews historically are a persecuted minority group, you know, especially in the old world. So this is a different situation. This is a situation where they are Bull Connor. They are essentially acting like the white majority in Alabama in the 1950s or before that, and enforcing their rule on their subject, rights-less, helot-type population, right? And so it's an absolute outrage, and that's what everybody is outraged about, okay? Is that you have millions of people who are being terribly oppressed. Oh, and I meant to say, I'm sorry, it's too many different directions to go with these things. One of the points that you need to understand about the oppression of the people in Gaza, it's a bit different now. They just get bombed to death all the time. They're getting bombed right now. But in the West Bank, this really is just like the nightmare. See, you're too young, Keith, but when I was a kid, okay, in fourth grade, they taught us, Texas legislature mandated that they teach us communism class for like 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We studied Soviet communism. And the point was that Soviet communism sucks, man. And it's so, you are so glad that you don't live there. And you know, I'll tell you what right now, my wife grew up in the Soviet Union and there ain't no question about that. It's an absolute totalitarian hellscape, okay? Anybody who tells you different is completely full of it, all right? But what they taught us about them was essentially that there's not really a law, right? There's just power. And the ruling party, the Communist Party, they can do whatever they want to you. And what they want to do to you is kick in your door in the middle of the night and take you away like monsters out of some, you know, horror story. Well, that's what the IDF does. The IDF, they are just exactly like the NKVD, in the Soviet Union, when they come and they abduct children, Keith, children, out of their beds at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning with their boot on the neck of their helpless father and take them away, bring them into a secret court where everybody's speaking Hebrew, where they have no rights, where they're held in administrative detention, which means exactly what it sounds like, no real judicial check. You might not even get a fake court-martial by a foreign government in a foreign language. And think about that happening to you, someone taking your child away in the middle of the night, and you can't do a thing about it. And if you resist, you're the terrorist, not them. And, oh, the accusation is he threw a rock at a tank that American taxpayers gave them. You know, oh, what danger the soldiers must have been in at the time. And they just, you know, you look at police abuse in America where they just gun down innocent black people, especially, you know, the worse the ghetto, the worse the collateral damage. Same thing there. They just kill people all the time. There's one just a few weeks ago. I interviewed Ali Abu Nima about it. It was a retarded kid, or I guess autistic on the spectrum, whatever you're supposed to say about it. A mentally challenged guy who they say was, you know, mentally the equivalent of a 4-year-old or a 7-year-old or something like that, you know, the way they say. And all he would do, he was terrified to leave the house. And the only time they could get him to engage in the community at all was he had this special school down the block that he would go to that he loved so much. And then one day the IDF just murdered him on the way to school for no reason but for fun. Terrorist, terrorist, bang, 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 bang. And they kill him dead with an American bought firearm and under the protection of the American Empire. And so back to the start of your questioning here on the show today about, you know, bin Laden's motivation for attacking the United States. You talked about the part about, you know, Zionist plans for using America to help to destabilize and disrupt and destroy the Middle East. You get some of that, and we skip to, we'll get back to that in just 1 second, but that was certainly part of it. But then the other part of it, of course, was American support for the Israeli occupation in Lebanon and in Palestine.
Yeah.
And that was what it was. He says it over and over again. And so he wasn't. And look, I got to tell you, if you read bin Laden's stuff, there's no question that he was against the existence of Israel altogether. Right. Israel, the Zionist regime must be destroyed. He didn't say anything about killing every last Jew there. Maybe he didn't have to. Maybe we'll take it for granted that's what he meant because he was a horrible SOB. Okay, fine. But the reality is, if the Israelis had just let the Palestinians go and have their measly stinking 22% of what's left of Palestine, they could have let them go in 79. They could have let them go in 94. They could have let them go in 2000. They could have let them go all these times. The Americans have been trying to push for this. You know, James Baker tried hard under H.W. Bush. What did the Israeli lobby do? They all supported Bill Clinton and got, you know, helped to get rid of H.W. Bush because his Secretary of State dared to try to force them to do the right thing for themselves. Because now look at what an untenable position their government has put them in, where half their population has, at best, third-class citizenship, but 90% of them have none and have no rights whatsoever, will never have citizenship, will never be Israelis, and yet will always be ruled by Israel, will never have independence, will never have their own form of government, will never have representation, will never have a lawyer that speaks Hebrew but actually has their interests at heart to help represent them in their military court-martial for being a 14-year-old boy with a stone. I mean, it's a nightmare, man. It's absolutely unacceptable. And you know what? This came up earlier on my radio show today. I was talking with this guy, Alan McLeod from FAIR. And we talked about, you know what? They never talked about this very much in public. There was some of it, but it was very true that this is why the Washington establishment hated Bernie Sanders so much. And I'm no Sanders supporter. You know me, man. I'm a Rothbardian guy. But this was the thing, was that he had the position that he thought they should let the West Bank go and that they should let the Palestinians go and have their independence and a two-state solution. It's been way too long of jerking these people around and pretending this is going to happen someday. And now's the time. And frankly, because of his character and his demeanor and everything. I mean, Larry David plays him on Saturday Night Live, right? The Jewishness of Bernie Sanders' character, a being from Brooklyn and his mannerism and everything. Call it stereotypical, whatever, in a cynical way if you want. That would have given him absolute nuclear bomb-proof armor to take on the Israel lobby in this country and the right-wing Likud party government in Israel and say, I've had enough of your garbage. And he used to live there on a kibbutz when he was a boy. And he has always, you know, sided with Israel, even in to degrees that I very much disapprove of, you know, helping to rationalize some of their bombing raids on Gaza and things like this in the past. But at the end of the day, what are they going to do? Call him an anti-Semite? You know, he sure as hell is the opposite of that, if he's anything at all. And so, and the thing is, because he's kind of an old line socialist leftist, the type of kind of sect of socialism that he comes from, it's just very much an economic viewpoint, right? He's not an identity politics guy where this side ought to be able to win the zero sum game against that side. Civil rights for all, equality for all, fairness for all. He's a 1960s guy. That's his brand of, you know, kind of new leftism, you know, that he carries on. He's, you know, in his 70s, he's from that era, and he was a civil rights, you know, member of the civil rights movement at that time. And so from the Israeli lobby's point of view, that was terrifying. That here's a guy who, and, you know, H.W. Bush tried this and lost an election over it. He did at one point. I don't know the exact words that they used, but it was, I think Baker said it for him. But it was something like, you know, we sure would be happy if there were a different prime minister in Israel right now. And it was Yitzhak Shamir, as Murray Rothbard said, the horrible Yitzhak Shamir. And Baker said, yeah, wouldn't it be great if they held new elections and got rid of that guy for us? And then blam, new elections, got rid of that guy. You know, what are they going to do? They're going to really step on Uncle Sam's toe when he says no? No, they will not. But they never forgot it, and they were pissed, and they fought back. And the Israel lobby in the United States said, fine, we'll support the Democrats then, which is exactly what happened. But Bernie Sanders, I mean, man, he could get away with it, I think. And yeah, they would support the Republican, but they would support him anyway. And I think Sanders is the kind of guy who could say, frankly, I wish they'd get rid of Netanyahu for me. What if they held some new elections and I had somebody who was more reasonable? I bet you he could get some results like that. And you know what? I don't know. He would have to really be dedicated to it. It would take all the political capital he had to say, no, I insist. You set the Palestinians free. The time for two states is passed. Here's the deal. Sign it. If anybody could have done it, it was him. And so that's why TV would never pay any attention to him. That's why the narrative always was, you can't have Sanders. You don't want Sanders. Sanders can't win. Sanders is bald. Sanders is too nerdy. Sanders has Bernie bros. Yeah, the only people who like Sanders are like white frat jocks. Really? That's the Sanders? Oh, okay. I guess if you say so. And they just, you know, they treated him the same way they treated Tulsi Gabbard. That, like, look, let me be honest with you, Keith, okay? You could choose Buttigieg, and you could choose Harris, and you could choose Warren, but Sanders is not one of your options, okay? And again, I'm not a Sanders supporter, but I'm just saying that was the narrative during the primary campaign. It was just like if you go back to the year 2008. Where you have Edwards, Hillary, and Obama over here, and you have Kucinich and Gravel over here. Okay, these two are just a sideshow, forget it. You're not allowed to pick from them. Neither of them are even really here. These are your choices, okay? That was the thing, and that was exactly what they did to Sanders again this time. The same thing that got him in such trouble last time, when the emails leaked of their outright conspiracy to do this to Sanders in 2016. That's what helped keep the left home and cost them the election to Donald Trump that fall. And, you know, that's their game.
Excellent. Scott, thank you so much for your time. As always, everyone, please check out Scott's excellent book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you, Keith. Appreciate it, man.